Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we speak with Georgetown University professor Abigail Marsh about the study she has done on psychopaths and altruists. Her new book is called The Fear Factor: How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between.
And then local psychotherapist Arch Wright of Red Willow Counseling and Recovery here in Park City. He'll talk about addiction, recovery, and some stories of his own that led him to the place of helping others. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doylney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, our first guest in her research uncovered a surprisingly simple mechanism lying behind our capacity for empathy. It's the ability to recognize others' fear. So she says, this one emotion connects us all. Psychopaths are not able to see it in others. Altruists are highly tuned in to the fear of others. Georgetown professor Abigail Marsh has researched these opposing ends of the spectrum about our sensitivity to others' fear. She's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience and directs the prize-winning Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience at Georgetown University. Abigail Marsh, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. So let's start with, no doubt you've done a huge body of research in your time as a professor of psychology and neuroscience. However, you had this personal experience that ended up making you really consider, what is it about others' ability to see fear in the rest of us?
Yeah, that's right. When I was 19, I had an experience that definitely really motivated me to try to understand why it is that we care about each other enough to sometimes take risks and make sacrifices to help them. When I was that age, had a car accident on a major freeway that could have easily ended up with my dying. I ended up stranded in the fast lane of the freeway. And couldn't get my car to restart to escape. And while I was trying to figure out what to do, a stranger appeared next to my car and offered to help. And he got my car running again and got me back to safety. And then after he made sure I was going to be okay, he said, "You take care of yourself," and he disappeared again. And it was the sort of thing that leaves a profound, I think, impact on, it would on anybody, it certainly did on me. That somebody would have taken the risks he did to save a stranger.
Right. And so you also equate this same sort of behavior in those who are compelled to, for example, donate a kidney to a stranger. And, putting yourself in harm's way, leaving yourself possibly compromised, but you are so compelled to do it. There's something almost, this force that is giving you the push that says, I have to do this.
That's exactly right. So in the research I've done since then, one of the projects I've done is recruiting people who've donated a kidney to a stranger, as you said, which is an amazing form of altruism. I call it extraordinary altruism because when you're helping a stranger who's anonymous to you, and giving up one of your own internal organs for them, it's really hard to explain that behavior as anything other than real altruism. And in interviewing the altruists that I've worked with, it's clear that they really are, as you say, sort of move, they're compelled to help in this situation where they know that somebody else's life is on the line.
And Dr. Marsh, to that point, I find it fascinating that you framed this discussion using the one emotion being fear, but the flip side of fear is love. And wouldn't altruistic behavior be driven by love? Or is it really the same thing? Are we looking at the flip side of exactly the same emotion?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Right. So, yes, I think it really is the case that for people who engage in acts of altruism, it is that love is overcoming fear, certainly for themselves. And that seems to be due to some really ancient brain structures and systems in our brain that, you know, way back in our early proto-mammalian past, enabled mother animals to overcome fear for their own safety to care for and protect their babies. And it seems like over time, those brain systems have been sort of adapted and expanded to allow us to care for anybody's welfare, not just that of our own babies, using all those same structures.
And you're seeing this now. I mean, you can actually see the changes in the brain through your MRIs, and maybe it's not the MRI, maybe it's some other wonderful technology that's been recently developed that's allowing us to see more clearly and more deeply into the brain structure and what's happening. But could you walk us through what you are seeing and discovering? Because every time we do a show like this, we find out there are these unbelievable technological breakthroughs that are allowing for a better understanding.
Yeah, the pace at which neuroscience is progressing is really incredible. I do use fMRI, and the main developments in the last decade or so have been in the kinds of technologies that we use to both collect data, we can get more sensitive data, and also analyze data. We have much better ways of analyzing the data to figure out what's going on in the brain. So what we found, what we did was we brought in a group of 19 altruistic kidney donors into Georgetown to do brain scans on them, and we scanned both activity in their brain and the structure of their brain. And what we found is that if you compare them to just ordinary adults who have never given anybody a kidney, people who have donated a kidney to a stranger have a structure called the amygdala that is both larger than in average people, and it's also more responsive to the signs of other people's fear. So if you show them a picture of somebody who's afraid, the amygdala is more active in response to that image than it would be in an average person. And the reason that's interesting is because prior research I've done with people who are psychopathic, so this is people who have unusually low levels of care and compassion, show exactly the opposite. So they have amygdalas that are too small and that are less responsive and in many cases not responsive at all to the signs of other people's fear. And so what this suggests is that people who are very altruistic just have a little extra, I don't know, horsepower in this key region of the brain that is responsible not just for experiencing fear yourself, which it is, it plays a major role in that, but also in understanding other people's fear. And somehow, again, via these processes we don't fully understand yet, although we're getting closer, somehow converting empathy for somebody else's fear, just understanding how they're feeling, into a desire to help them, into a desire to make them feel better.
And so you just said we're getting close to a better understanding, and it makes me wonder, do we have an understanding of how people gain that extra horsepower or lack that horsepower, why one person's amygdala is larger and another's is smaller, or is that where we're headed to gain that understanding?
That is one of the things we're still working on, using much larger brain scanning samples than we've used in the past. So huge data sets are now being collected where we can get a better sense of how the brain develops. We don't really know for sure why it is that some people end up more altruistic than others, although, as is true for almost any other psychological outcome, it's definitely a mix of genetic factors and then also life experiences. Those are both involved in everything. And we know that the structure and size of the amygdala is at least in part heritable, so about 60% of the variation in the amygdala is due to genetic factors. And that, interestingly, is about the same amount of genetic component in variation in both psychopathic and altruistic traits. So about 60% of variation in those personality traits is due to genetic factors. But that leaves a lot of room left over for other things. You know, whether it's the effects of early life experiences and parenting, or whether it's the effects of perhaps being sort of predisposed to be a little more altruistic from the get-go, and then engaging in altruistic behaviors that are a little more common, like donating blood or maybe even donating bone marrow, and experiencing the rewards of helping other people, then causes changes in the brain that then leads up to these more extraordinary acts of altruism as another possibility.
Abigail, I feel compelled to tell you about this instance that I experienced last night at the Salt Lake City airport. I'm fascinated by psychopaths, but the study of psychopaths. But I'm also wondering if there is some portion of when you have an oversized amygdala, as in the case of many altruists, does it also hamper your behavior in some way at the same time? And I'll explain. Last night at the Salt Lake City airport, it must have been return missionary day. And I'm speaking of Mormon missionaries who go away for 2 years and they come back after, like, they haven't seen their families. They're young. They're 19 when they go. They haven't seen their families for 2 years. And there were these huge groups of people waiting for their missionaries to return. And I sat there and I probably cried like five different times just watching these. I was waiting for my son to come home from college. I was so excited and I hadn't seen my son for a month, you know. And I see these groups of families and each time I just cried imagining their how they felt about not seeing their missionary for 2 years. And then a friend of mine came off the flight and he was grumbling and he said, "Only in Salt Lake City would this happen," you know. And then we laughed about our various responses to these returned missionaries. So I feel sometimes quite hampered by this this response in myself that every time someone else is experiencing something, I take it to the nth degree of empathy. And I have to say, I don't like that about myself. I think it's somewhat good to be sensitive to others, but I literally could not control my tears. So,
wow.
Talk about that if you would.
It's a beautiful story, first of all. It's really a lovely example of empathy, how you were extrapolating from how you felt not seeing your own son for a month to how it must feel for these families to be seeing their children after years have gone by. And sort of resonating with their experiences and having this really incredibly compassionate response to it. So, you know, part of me doing this work, the thing that strikes me the most is just how beautiful the emotions are that humans are equipped with. And it's too easy to forget that sometimes, I think, especially in the present moment. So I really love hearing stories like yours. That said, it's not always easy to be in the inside of those experiences because those are really strong emotions that can be anything from exhausting to sort of give you a sense of burnout. My response would be, first of all, I would love to know what people who know you well think about this trait in you, because it may be that this is, among people who know you well, this is one of their favorite things about you, and it might be helping maintain strong relationships between your friends and family, that they know that you have this sort of deep empathic resonance with them. Another thing I can tell you is that there are people who would argue that practices like compassion and loving kindness meditation, which are a very particular kind of meditation. Some people lump all kinds of meditation together, but they're really quite different. And those practices are specifically aimed at training people to feel sort of positive, compassionate emotions for other people without so much of the depleting, what you might call negative empathic experiences, empathizing with harder emotions like sadness or fear. Mm-hmm. And so I might recommend getting some experience in those practices. It might be a way to help lessen the burden of feeling other people's strong emotions.
Mm. Yeah, that's great.
It does seem to work.
Yeah, channeling that positive emotion or empathy. So I'm curious about psychopaths. I know how easily it is to identify them. You talk in your book about groups of children and seeing, I forget the percentage of people that are psychopathic, and when you identify them, how you then get them to come into your lab to undergo a functional MRI.
Right. It is a challenge, no doubt about it. And it's been one of the really delightful things about working with altruistic populations is how incredibly easy it actually is to reach out to them and to bring them into the lab. Working with children who have psychopathic traits is harder, but oftentimes their parents are so incredibly exhausted and frantic for answers about what is happening with their children that they are interested in bringing them in to get any answers they can about why their child is so consistently causing problems. And so we use a variety of methods. We work with some local institutions that are, you know, inpatient facilities for kids with behavior problems. But we also recruit just using flyers that say things like, does your child have serious behavior problems and not feel guilty when they do something wrong? And, you know, parents have a variety of reactions to that. Every so often we'll get a call from a parent who says, well, my child does not look both ways before they cross the street, and he doesn't seem to understand why that's a bad thing. And to that parent I say, you know, I understand, and yet you are fortunate that that is your child's worst behavior. But many other children whose parents call in response to that have really serious behavior problems, aggression and, you know, manipulating and lying all the time and theft and you name it.
Now, that would indicate, as we spoke earlier, that there is a strong predisposition and genetic component, because what age are you starting to see some of those behaviors? And I would imagine by the time you're recognizing it and you're being contacted by parents, the parents have been dealing with it for quite some time, long enough for them to go, wow, there's something up here.
Exactly. No, the parents are actually the people I feel a particular degree of compassion for, because they're just dealing with such a difficult problem that doesn't seem to have a good solution. There aren't yet great treatments for children who have these what are now called limited prosocial emotions. That's the official psychiatric term for it, is low empathy, low remorse, and constant behavior problems. I'm hoping that eventually people will come to understand this particular issue as kind of in the same way we understand disorders like autism or schizophrenia now. Once upon a time, people believed that schizophrenia and autism were caused by bad mothering. There was this schizophrenogenic mother way back in the 1900s, the idea that, you know, sort of cold and unreliable mothers cause their children to be schizophrenic. And then more recently, people believe that this thing called a refrigerator mother, really cold, again, always cold mothers that cause their children to have mental illnesses. And then, of course, as time's gone on, we've done more research, we've realized actually these are disorders that do have a strong genetic component. Nothing's hardwired, but people are at risk for different things based on their genetics. That's certainly true. And it's, again, it's true for every psychological condition. Once we realize that that's true, once we realize that these are, you know, psychological disorders that have a basis in brain dysfunction, we learn to identify them earlier and earlier, and we get better and better at treating them. And so I hope the same thing will eventually be true for psychopathy, that we just understand this isn't just bad parents. This is something much deeper going on. And we learn to identify it younger and younger. We're already able to do that a little bit better now. There have been a few studies done recently showing that both behavioral and neural responses to other people's fear, fearful facial expressions, and also fearful vocalizations, so scared voices, atypical responses to those, even in children who are preschool age, 2, 3, 4, are a risk factor for developing later psychopathic traits. And so once we figure that out, we can probably develop more effective treatments.
So if you take a random group of preschoolers or kindergartners or young kids, and you put them in a room, what are the odds that you're going to find, what's the percentage that is likely to indicate some behavior that would send up a warning flag? And then, double question here, because Lynn limits me to how many I can ask, so I have to combine them sometimes. But then, when you talked about treatment, what do you do with those kids? How do you treat them?
Okay, well, the first question's easier. The second one is a lot harder. So the estimate for how many people in the population are highly psychopathic is maybe 1 or 2%. So in a group of 20 or 30 kids, maybe none, or maybe one at most. In a group of 100 kids, that's probably 1 or 2. Now, psychopathy is not a sort of its own separate category. The traits vary in the population, and so there's a bigger subset of kids that do have elevated psychopathic traits and are probably also causing problems. And, you know, how those kids fare as they develop is probably going to depend on a lot of different things, how severe their problems were to begin with, and the environment they find themselves in, and how their parents respond. Unfortunately, what sometimes happens is that kids who have these traits are, you know, very badly behaved sometimes from a very early age, and their parents, in an effort to control them, respond by elevating their punishment. So elevating from, you know, low-level punishments and timeouts to sometimes, you know, really harsh parenting practices, which unfortunately don't work. They don't really work for children in general. They're not. That's not a good way to train children to do anything. So it's nice that there's a universal recommendation is that harsh parenting does not make children behave better. But it's especially true for children with these traits because of their relatively fearless temperaments. Because if you don't have a strong experience of fear, then punishment is really ineffective because that's how punishment works. Mm-hmm. You fear being punished, so you don't do the bad thing. And so in general, the advice is true for all kids that the parenting practices that work best tend to be reward-focused. So children are consistently rewarded only when they do the things they're supposed to do. And especially for children who have these psychopathic traits, they seem to do best with very warm and responsive parents, parents who are at the very high end of those qualities, which admittedly is difficult when children are badly behaved, but it does seem to be at least somewhat effective.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Georgetown University Professor Abigail Marsh. Her new book is called The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. And as you know, Abigail, there's so much work being done now within neuroscience showing us more and more how the plasticity in the of the brain and how if we catch things at an early age, we're able to affect a huge change, not just in behavior, but actually in the way the brain is growing and shaping and forming. And I had this fascinating conversation with someone recently who was doing a PhD in the study of autism, and she was saying that they can detect signs of autism in babies at about 3 months old. And if they detect it early enough, they are able to do therapy that actually changes their brain so that it will move them off the spectrum, which I thought was fascinating. Now, so take that into psychopathy. And if we're able to identify these behaviors quite early, is there a chance to, say, grow the amygdala in the brain?
I think so. I think that there's every reason to be optimistic about that. Again, we can identify the risk factors for psychopathy in early childhood. There's not nearly as much research that's been done on this as on autism, right? There are no, sort of parental advocacy organizations for these children because of the stigma, the way that there is for autism. But maybe one day there will be. I hope so. I think there's every reason to think that if we can identify children who are at the highest risk early on, that using behavior therapy, we could absolutely change this course of development. There's every reason to think that.
Mm. Well, that's hopeful. We did an interview some years ago, and I will just never forget it. And I know you must know this gentleman who's a PhD, a researcher, I think he's a neuroscientist, James Fallon. Who,
yep.
Yeah, everyone knows this guy. So he, for our listeners, he was studying psychopaths, and he sent out this survey to a bunch of people he knew and his family, and everyone did this survey, and they were anonymous. They just had a number, and one of the surveys came back. This person, number 16, is clearly a psychopath, and it turned out to be himself. The interesting thing is when he told his people who knew him very well, they said, okay, yeah, I can see that. Well, what it did for him, even though he wasn't a full-on psychopath who went out murdering people, he was able to then sort of, he grew up in the best environment with great parents and great education. And so he was able to sort of control and shape his environment, which I just think is fascinating that he wouldn't then, turn into a full psychopath. Maybe he just stopped at sociopath. what are your thoughts on that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, so James Fallon obviously he's a wonderful writer and has a very compelling story. I don't actually know if he's ever been assessed by a real sort of trained clinician who assesses psychopaths. I don't know how accurate his own self-assessment is, and I would hesitate to make too many comments on it without knowing whether he's been assessed properly.
Uh-huh.
And I think I also would like to correct, I think, some misinformation that's out there following his talk in his book, which is that he was able to tell from his brain scan that he was a, quote, psychopath. And that's actually impossible. There is no way to diagnose anybody with any mental illness using an fMRI brain scan or a structural MRI brain scan at this point in time. And I say this because, often parents will come in asking and hoping that we can diagnose their child using a brain scan. And I know that there are people out there who charge huge amounts of money to give kids brain scans and the promise of a diagnosis. And so I this is sort of a public service announcement. That's
yeah.
not possible. We are still in the very early stages of understanding how the brain works in that level of detail. That said, it's clearly true that there are people who start out with these very callous and uncaring personality traits that, due to other advantages they have, whether it's having pretty good executive function, so reasonably good self-control, or in some cases it's finding something that they're passionate about early on that keeps them on the straight and narrow. For example, the test pilot, Chuck Yeager, who was the first to break the sound barrier, one of the great psychopathy experts believed that as a child he probably had psychopathic personality traits, but because he discovered his love of flying, that sort of kept him on the straight and narrow path because he knew if he got into trouble, he would never be able to become a pilot in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a lot to be said for discovering something that you're passionate about, which helps keep your behavior in check. Even if you are relatively insensitive to punishment, and even if you're maybe not the world's most compassionate person, there are ways to overcome that initial limitation.
Okay. So this is leaving a question in my mind about functional MRI. So if you have an MRI that shows you have a very small amygdala, that doesn't necessarily correlate to psychopathic traits.
Exactly. At the individual level, we wouldn't be able to say for sure, and that's for a lot of reasons, one of which is that the amygdala is made up of a lot of different little pieces, and probably some of them are much more relevant than others when it comes to things like altruism and psychopathy, but right now we can't see those details using an MRI brain scan. And so while we can see that if you look across, for example, 40 people, the ones with the bigger amygdalas are the most altruistic, and the ones with the smaller amygdalas tend to be the most psychopathic. There are certainly exceptions to that. And so we would never want to say with confidence that any one person was anything based on a brain scan, even though we can see very clear patterns when we look across groups of people.
I don't want to beat the brain scan issue to death, but it did occur to me while you were talking about, parents coming in and asking for their children to have a brain scan to show certain things. I mean, do you see sometime in the future, just taking what has happened over the last 15 years with neuroscience and MRI technology and projecting out another 15 years into the future, do you think there will be a time when, at a very early age, let's say, the first baby checkup that a baby goes in for with a parent, that you pop the baby into an MRI machine and run it through? And it's not to give a diagnosis necessarily, but it's to see certain things like how developed is the amygdala from a genetic standpoint? Do we need to be paying attention to certain things? And can the brain scan show us those components that we would then maybe pay a little extra attention to?
I think the price would have to come way down first.
Right.
The usual screenings that pediatricians do in young children are pretty cheap, whereas a brain scan usually costs thousands of dollars. So my guess is probably not in the next 15 years, but I would say it's impossible that at some point we would know enough about the brain and have sensitive enough scans that we could use a brain scanner to get a general mental health checkup in children. Although my guess is that even better than that would be if we can use our understanding of how the brain affects behavior to come up with quick screening measures like are used for autism. We don't diagnose early childhood autism using a brain scan necessarily, but we look for behavioral traits that we know correlate with the different kinds of developing brain problems that characterize autism. And maybe we could develop measures like that for psychopathy as well.
And you talked about how there are these advocacy groups for autism that didn't exist a very short period of time ago. And we had a different sense. It was, you know, bad parenting, cold mm-hmm. mothers, things like that. Mm-hmm. And there is a similarity between psychopathy and autism. They're both spectrums. They both have, you know, brain components. And do you see, are we headed in that direction where, and I guess this is a bigger question, we're just understanding more and more about the brain. So we're going to mm-hmm. view things much differently than we did a very short period of time ago. And we can expect to have a different sense of diagnosis and cause and advocacy groups for things like psychopathy. Is that
right? Psychopathy, yeah.
In the future.
I think so. And actually, one thing that gives me cause for optimism is the way that substance abuse has, or at least our views of substance abuse, have changed so much in the last decade or so. And I think there's been an enormous shift from people thinking of substance abuse as mainly a moral failing to something's gone wrong in the brain. These substances have hijacked people's brains and created addictions that it's really difficult to shake. And we don't get very far by throwing them in jail. That doesn't actually fix the problem. And we do much better when we view it as a disorder that needs to be treated. And so that actually gives me a lot of hope that something that was viewed, a decade or two ago as primarily a moral failing is now being treated as a public health problem. And so I think we might get to the point where we treat persistent aggression the same way. It's like it's very easy to just view it as a moral failing and condemn people who engage in persistent aggression and just throw them in jail. But when we realize it's not actually helping them, and it's certainly not helping society at large, maybe we'll view it as more of a public health problem.
Well, there's not only the social cost of our current method, which is, as you say, institutionalize them, throw them in jail. There's a tremendous financial cost. And do you see the shift going from, you know, sort of the current model of lock them up and the cost, the financial cost associated with that, if we could divert some of those resources to this type of, you know, recognition and dealing with these issues at an early age and as Lynn pointed out, rewiring the brain at a very early age, you have a social benefit and you also have a financial benefit, it seems to me. Is the money there if we could just repurpose it?
Well, I have to say, I haven't been terribly impressed as of late with Americans' ability to let practical considerations overcome feelings of moral self-righteousness. And so we've got a ways to go to start thinking about health and wellness and criminal behavior in practical terms. What can we do to make the problem better rather than what makes us feel good? Because, you know, punishing people who've done wrong makes us feel really good. We're built to like to punish people who have done us wrong. So that said, I think that the tide does seem to be shifting a little bit in a good direction. And so yes, I think, you know, there's always, I think when you're looking at an approach that will save money, there's every reason to think that we could shift the way that we deal with persistent offenders. You know, we have, for example, drug courts that are specially designed to deal with substance users and have a completely different way of dealing with them than with dealing with people who are, you know, have committed burglary or something. And I think, especially when it comes to kids, there might be some willingness to think about what makes sense in how we can deal with kids whose persistent aggression is not responding to punishment so that we are all safer as these kids get older rather than having them become long-time adult offenders. Maybe.
Very interesting. Well, the book is called The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. Our guest is Georgetown University Professor Abigail Marsh. It's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
How about that? You learned something from that interview, didn't you?
Yes.
A lot. I'm going to shrink my amygdala.
Yeah. No, I can answer that question. Those who know Lynn Ware Peake well, that's one of the things we appreciate about you. Don't go changing.
Don't go changing. Well, it's interesting, however, the experience that she had where she was facing oncoming traffic in her car and not being able to start it, and a stranger appears like an angel and helps her get it started. that stranger probably didn't even think, should I, shouldn't I, should I, should. It was just, you know, as we use the word a lot of times, he was compelled to come and help her. And I don't know, you know, I have empathy in certain ways, and you know, maybe empathy is categorized by what sort of instance that you're in. I cry when I see returned missionaries coming back to the Salt Lake City airport. So funny.
But you're not going to run out into traffic because the fear factor outweighs the altruistic behavior instinct.
Yes, perhaps. Yeah. Perhaps.
So that goes on all the time, I think. I like the way it sort of ties into our what's happening in our community right now. We're having conversations about mental wellness, and we have this initiative that's grown rapidly over the last year, and it ties right into, she was nibbling at the edges of what it means to be well and what it means to be a well community and the societal effects and influences and behaviors and how it kind of trickles down to right here in our little local community. So it's
right.
Nice to see that we're sort of on the cutting edge, it sounds like, for mm-hmm. some of these issues.
Right. And speaking of altruism, she's saying in her book that altruism, even though we seem to be in a culture where we are increasingly entitled and self-serving, that altruism actually is growing. And certainly we see that. We just saw it in November, Live PC, Give PC,
yes.
And we see it around the holidays, that altruism is alive and well and getting bigger, which is great. Well, stay with us. We will be back to talk about addiction and recovery. It's The Mountain Life.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, ESCO.
This is J.C. Coleman, manager of the Park City branch of Fairway Independent Mortgage, helping out KPCW. Celebrating 20 years, the Fairway Independent Mortgage team provides lending options for jumbo, conventional, condo, hotel financing, and more for the Park City homebuyer, located at 1245 Deer Valley Drive. Details at lendtopc.com, NMLS number 2289.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Our next guest is local psychotherapist Archibald Wright, with over 30 years of experience working in what he calls the trenches of recovery. He connects well with those impacted by addiction, both addicts and loved ones alike, whether it's addiction to substances or processes like spending, gambling, codependency, sex, love, work. The underlying causes, he says, and conditions are usually the same. Wright has experience not only working with addicts, but the family members and those who are codependent and emotionally distressed as well. His business is called Red Willow Counseling and Recovery, right here in Park City. Arch Wright, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn, and I owe you a big apology. We exchanged messages, and I thought it was tomorrow morning, but you got me. Your staff got me on the phone, and this is fine. Sorry I'm not there in person.
Oh, well, we'll miss you in the studio, but thanks for being here. And, you know, first of all, let's just talk, because I think you were quite open about this, about your own experience with addiction and then recovery. And it's probably quite a long story, but maybe you can tell us where it all began.
Sure. And I am open. It's a little risky to be too open as a therapist. They teach you that in school, and I did just go back and get my master's degree in my early 50s a couple of years ago and changed careers to become a counselor. But the risk in getting too personal at this level or anywhere working with a client is if the therapist hasn't done their own work, then they can fall into having self-disclosure be more about them than the work that needs to be done for the benefit of the client. So we don't hear a lot of therapists talking about their own journey, and uh-huh. it's a good idea. I have done a lot of work, and that 30-year comment came from, you know, what I offer to my clients and everywhere I travel in my life is my own experience. And I have done a ton of work, and I continue to do my own work on my journey to wholeness, which is what I would say it all began for me in a family that, you know, had everything, quote-unquote, on the outside. I mean, we weren't uber-wealthy, but we were definitely upper-middle class, and everything looked real good. And my parents, I want to say right now, my parents and other adults in my life, especially my parents, did the best they knew how and did a lot of things really well, really well. In fact, many of the qualities I have and skills and ways of living life today are directly from things I learned from both my mom and dad. With that having been said, they only had the skills that they had from their upbringing. And, you know, what I've now learned through my own 33 years, next month it'll be 34 years, clean and sober from alcohol and all mind-altering chemicals. And I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, I was definitely a full-blown alcoholic, drug addict, living in Park City, by the way, back in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, so I've been able to, over those 34 years, dig even deeper than just getting over the drug and alcohol problem and looking at how I have, you know, tried to adapt to insecurities in myself that I've been carrying around since childhood. And I believe, and I've worked, and I have colleagues and have done training with world authorities on this topic, and I believe that approximately two-thirds of us have significant underlying issues from early in life that are impacting us in a way that we are either already struggling with substance or process-related compulsivity and obsession. That's another word for addiction, mm-hmm. compulsivity and obsession. And when you do that list, that list of substances or the processes that you mentioned. So, you know, I feel like I'm in good company, and yet I'm trying to reach out to help people look for a more satisfying existence, basically. I'm happy to tell you more about the details of the journey that I've been on.
Well, let me ask you this. Well, for yourself and for the people that you work with, addiction to substance or addiction to processes, as you call it, how do those surface? I mean, is there a difference between those two? Is it, you know, the person who initially becomes addicted to something that seems positive, like work? You know, mm-hmm. are they different from someone who becomes addicted to alcohol or drugs?
Well, this good question, and gosh, we're right. Literally every day there's news around sex addiction because of the clearly offending behaviors around sex that have been happening. And I think I'm so pleased that this stuff is coming out. There's a big difference between sex addiction and sex offending. They're often together, but they're two very separate things. So I want to say that, you know, we have to define addiction, and I don't want to go too far down that hole, but that is at the center of a whole lot of discussion on the national level right now, and I'm even involved with some larger news reporting organizations and have been interviewed a little bit recently because I'm a certified sex addiction therapist, and so I have some expertise in that area, but again, my own journey is probably the thing that informs me the most. But what I would say is that addiction can be defined, this is one way that's very widely believed, is it's powerlessness and unmanageability. And, you know, and addiction comes with a very deep denial system. So unfortunately, the person who's addicted, whether it's work or sex or love or alcohol, is the last one to admit it. And so you've got that denial structure. And so it's up to others to decide for a while when they're looking at their beloved family member, do I see powerlessness? and or unmanageability? Are there consequences as a result of this behavior or this use of substances? And so we generally look at the, you know, the nine areas of balance in life, and we can, with regards to work and sex and those kinds of things, which are a little less under the radar because everybody, you know, we're wired to have sex, right? And we need to work and we need to eat. So those addictions are very tricky because they're not as easy to pick up on the drunk driver. And so we'll look at somebody, well, you know, if they're working 80 hours a week and they haven't been to their kid's football game ever, and they're not connected with their spouse, they haven't had sex in 3 months, and they argue, and there's maybe the beginnings of an emotional affair starting at work, you know, but yet there's lots of money rolling in, the kids are in fine schools, and in some ways they all think they're happy too, because there's, again, money seems to be at the center of a lot of this stuff. If things are on a roll financially, everybody's happy. Until usually what happens, or often, and I see a lot of this in Park City, the teenagers are the ones who really, really end up with the problem. Mm-hmm. And they aren't the problem. They're the manifestation that is tragic and sad, but the problem is in the family system. And it's camouflaged by success, according to quote-unquote what society thinks success is.
Arch, how do you determine that threshold that I think you just delineated? You talked about obsessive-compulsive behavior and then a way to say, because I'm thinking obsessive-compulsive behavior, if it's channeled in the right way, could have very beneficial consequences and outcomes. And I'm sure that's the case, you know, to a degree. But when it becomes powerless and unmanageable, then it steps over that line into what you would call addiction. Or maybe it's all addiction and it's just different degrees of addiction and you have to be concerned about all of it? Or is there a threshold that, you know, makes it something to be worried about?
Yeah, that's it. That's a great question. And it's I think, what makes a good therapist, what makes a good doctor, what makes a good religious leader, preacher. You know, these are the people who spouses, typically, of the one who's, and spouses, it's a family system thing, the spouse who's the one who's stepping up and saying, hey, asking for help through a therapist or their doctor or a close friend or their preacher, you know, what do I do here? You know, my husband's, you know, doing such and such. He's drinking more, or he's at the office, and I think there might be an affair starting. And so people who are in the position to help others are hopefully have a lot of experience and education, a formal education. And like I said, personal experience helps a ton around this stuff because there is no blood test for addiction. And with regards to work and sex and those types of things, it's so easy to look the other way if there's success in terms of the amount of money being made, et cetera. But really, it boils in addiction is secret too. Addicts of any type have two lives. Once it becomes, and it's a line that we don't know, we don't have any blood test or any way to tell it, a person crosses over the line to where they are obsessing. And when you're obsessing, you're not thinking about what's going on in the moment or other things. So you're not present when your mind is obsessing about something in the future or in the past, which addicts have both going on. They're scrambling around all over in their mind. It's the opposite of mindfulness. We hear so much about mindfulness, and that happens to be one of the key recovery principles for people who are recovering from addiction, is it's a major job of becoming more mindful because they have to be mindful to plan for this secret life. And then the compulsivity is there's a whole lot of science we still don't know. We still know far less that we don't know than we do know. There's a lot of neurochemical discovery going on around addiction, that there are literally studies that show in the brains of high-intensity Wall Street trading floor stock traders, cocaine addicts and meth addicts and sex addicts have the same exact stuff that goes on in regions of their brain when they're high, when they hit the big stock trade, or when they're in the midst of a sex addiction acting out scenario. And so you've got substances and behaviors that do the same darn thing in the brain. And this addiction is pretty decidedly a brain-related disease. Depending on who you talk to, it could, I believe it's a spiritual slash existential, not to be confused with religious. I believe at its core we have to recover successfully and meaningfully. We have to dig deep into existential issues, and each of us need to have our own process of that, where we don't all follow the same path there.
So, Arch, you became a therapist 2 years ago, and this is an issue that's really getting a lot of attention within our community today. We're starting to talk about mental wellness, and I know you're involved mm-hmm. with the Mental Wellness Alliance. And I had an experience Monday where I was at a drug court graduation, which was just unbelievable. And Roy, who's mm-hmm. one of the specialists, stood up and talked about, you know, addicts don't choose to be addicts. It's something that happens to them. But then there are these things that we can do as a society. Instead of locking addicts up, we can help work with them and turn them into productive members of the community. And I know that's what the Mental Wellness Alliance at the core is about. And what do you see as the possibility within our community for those sorts of actions and initiatives?
Well, I think they're wonderful. And yes, Roy's fantastic. And Ollie and Aaron and Shona and the whole. I was gone all last year at an internship in Arizona for my my license and my degree. And so when I came back, I was still through. But I was, of course, very aware of the terrible tragedies of the teenagers. And so I came back pretty pumped up to jump in. And I'm I lived in Vail, Colorado, for 15 years and was very active. And I lived up in Bozeman for a number of years. In the last 25 years, I've been in both of those communities. I've seen drug court stuff. I've seen communities rally and do efforts. And this one far surpasses anything I've seen, and it's just wonderful. I see a lot of work coming on the treatment end, helping people coming out of jail, helping people in need, the identified patient, if you will, in the family system. What I have been bringing up since I've been back about a year now and sitting in on some of the Alliance meetings is that, you know, that's great. We've got to do it. In some way, it continues to shine light on what's going on, but the real work has to come in prevention. And it's not that the Alliance, they've always had that in there. It's like so many things. Prevention is at a certain level, addiction is really, nobody really understands it, too, very clearly and concisely and scientifically yet. So there's lots of different approaches about how to go about with prevention efforts. There's some pretty radically different ones. The Western medical science pharmacological approach is the one that gets, in my opinion, most of the money and resources and political attention. You know, the one that combines mental health with substance use?
Yes.
Well, there's an enormous amount of knowledge and energy that's been around for decades and decades that focuses on family systems and developmental trauma that I've been talking about in my own family. I'm in that camp much more. So I think that the efforts long-term
We're out of time.
We're getting up again.
We are out of time. Sorry about that. We have to cut you off, but thanks for joining us today on The Mountain Life. It was great that you called in.
Thanks, Arch. And we want to thank our underwriters, Valley Behavioral Health, Jim Doylney and Mark Wingsgard with retail at New Park, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, and Fairway Independent Mortgage, along with Park City Mountain, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for news.